Both here and elsewhere, Hegel seems to defend war. War makes explicit what is implicit in every state structure, namely that the life of the polis is built on the death of its citizens. How come? For Hegel, the state is literally built on the sacrifice of the individual to the whole that is the nation. Think of the problem this way. We are all spontaneously narcissistic creatures. We are all spontaneously self-interested. And everyday life seems to require this. And therefore, everyday life is necessarily forgetful that the possibility of everyday life has its ground in the state. That is, what allows me to cross the street is that there are red lights. What allows me to walk the streets is that there are police and laws. What allows me to get up in the morning and make coffee is that there's electricity and so forth. We are always immersed in our private, self-seeking lives on these deep structures and the laws that regulate them. We are always dependent on the whole. And nothing is more human, and indeed even necessary, I would argue, than to forget that fact. Can't live in constant acknowledgement of it. War comes as a way of regenerating our communal solidarity. War is a way of reminding us that we are members of a whole and that we are dependent on that whole for our life, and that as citizens we are operating in a sacrificial mode, the sacrifice of the particular to the universal, because it's the universal is the system of structures and practices. Right? And it's that which must continue. And at that level, as I argued last week, the individual is just a thing, right? Not a, doesn't have the moment of their private self-interest. Antigone's deed reveals that the ultimate concern of the state is for itself. That every state has both a necessary and a terrible moment of its interest of itself as a whole beyond the life of any particular citizens. And it must have that if it's to be a state that fulfills all those roles. Conversely, the ultimate concern of the family is for the life of the individual. So the family exists for exactly taking account of the individual in their individuality beyond their role as being a bearer of a role within a state totality. Antigone's action is about the destruction of the false unity represented by this structure. The reason seems clearly enough that Antigone is not recognized as a citizen because of the sexual division of labor. But if she's not recognized as an individual, then in fact, no individual in this world ever fully appears as an individual. So what makes Greek ethical life what it is that in it, individuals have no subjectivity, no interest of their own, no individuality, no singularity. In this world, the world of the Greeks, we understand individuals through the roles they carry out. The role is the source and ground of one's self-understanding. The distinction between the modern and the pre-modern depends on the thought that in the classical world, individuals are only finally bearers of roles. And this is central to Hegel's analysis. Neither Antigone nor Creon act from personal motivation. Neither Antigone nor Creon act from conscience. Nor do Antigone or Creon reflect on what they ought to do. Ismene tries to get Antigone to reflect. But Antigone thinks that the thought of reflection would be a blockage between her and her role. Right? Now, of course, she's both right and wrong. Because Ismene says, look, there's another role you have, namely as a member of the Greek polis. So the relationship between Antigone and Ismene plays out that sense that the two sides are interpenetrate, and to alienate yourself from one side is to undergo self-alienation. So you need both Antigone and Ismene to see that any action, both action and inaction, turns out to be self-alienation under these circumstances. So, for Hegel, the determination of Creon and Antigone's actions is simply a determination given by their role. Paragraph 465, Hegel says, and I don't know until I get there what he says. The ground from which this movement starts and on which it takes place is the ethical realm. What is active in this movement, however, is self-consciousness. Qua ethical consciousness, It is the simple, pure direction of activity towards the essentiality of ethical life. That is duty. That is, action is exactly what Bradley thinks it should be all the time. My station and its duty. That famous essay, where he thought he was going to bring back ethicality. Misunderstanding Hegel completely. Right? Hegel's actually arguing against that, but it is what he thinks goes on in the Greek world. Consequently, and just to rub this in, a couple of sentences down, we are not faced with the, and this is an irony here, the sorry spectacle. He's trying to say, do not try to make either Creon or Antigone into modern subjects. Do not misread them as moderns, as, for example, Hölderlin was in part tempted to do. Consequently, we are not faced with the sorry spectacle of a collision between passion and duty, nor with the comic spectacle of a collision between duty and duty, a collision which, as regards its content, is the same as that between passion and duty. These actions are understood as spontaneous. For Antigone, Creon is just a tyrant. For Creon, Antigone is the feminine who is indifferent to the universality of the state. Stated like that, there can be no reconciliation between these two sides. In ethical terms, they are both guilty and they both suffer their guilt. Their blindness to their position within the whole means that they both must suffer. The deed achieves the work of diremptying the whole and showing its internal scission. So, one thing that Hegel is telling us now is one of the reasons why the Greek world appears beautiful, remember it's not beautiful, but it appears beautiful, is because of the difference between immediacy of my station and its duties, and our culture, which he calls a culture of reflection. Reflexion culture? More or less?
Yeah, more or less. Okay.
What's the difference here? When I have to figure out what to do, I have to step back from the world and reflect. I have to think about what I want, what the moral consequences of my actions are, who is involved in them, who do I need to take account of, who not, what the laws are. In short, the conditions of action for us are conditions of wild mediation, that we are always already, in that sense, alienated from the world of which we are nonetheless a part. And we must be. And I'm going to say it's a good thing that this is a level of alienation that Hegel wants to embrace. Conversely, the Greeks appear beautiful because their relationship to their reality is unreflected. It is immediate. And it comes out as you do what your station requires. We'll find the other condition for beauty in a moment. Well, the objections to this analysis, and I want to use the objection as a way of motivating a deeper understanding of what the analysis is, are legion. Nearly everyone thinks that Hegel got it wrong. And they thought so from the get-go, right? Everyone just thought he was making mistakes. So Goethe argues that this play is not a play about city and family. It is not about the collapse of the whole, but it is a celebration of Greek classicism. That's the one that always finds, for me, just puzzling. It's Goethe being willfully classicist. I have no idea. He does say correctly that Antigone never admits guilt. Antigone, he says, is the heroine, and Creon, the bad guy. And indeed, it is clear, I think, that Sophocles meant the play to be a defense of Antigone against Creon. Sophocles, as I mentioned earlier, meant it as a defense of tradition. He meant it as a defense of the old gods versus the new gods. Nonetheless, I was just rereading last night A.C. Bradley's beautiful essay on Hegel and tragedy. And he says, nonetheless, this play would not be a tragedy unless there was a fundamental conflict. And there can only be a fundamental conflict if both sides have a moment of rightness about them. That is, what makes it tragic. Otherwise, it's just a story about our doubting heroine going up against a miserable state apparatus, and therefore it's a very sad play. It's not a tragedy. It's just bad news. What makes it tragic is that even she must feel the pull of the alternative side, even though she thinks it's wrong. So if even she feels, then, and this is the point of Hegel's analysis, then the question of who is the hero and who's the bad guy is at the wrong level of analysis. Patricia Mills, in an early article that really pulled together, I think, significantly, a really excellent essay, pulls together most writing from a kind of Marxist feminist position, launched a whole series of criticisms, of which there are four essential ones. The first, according to her, read what she says. The first is that Hegel completely disregards, she says, the sister-sister relationship in his search for the ideal relationship as a male-female relationship of identity indifference. Now, it is perfectly true that this is driven by, and this, of course, is what Derrida harps on about, and everyone harps on about, there is some, as it were, something about the brother-sister relationship that seems special. I want to say that, like everything else I think that's peculiar in Hegel is in the play. that the reason that he harps on the brother-sister thing is because Antigone does. She says, lovers, parents, children, but the brother is irreplaceable. That's her argument, not Hegel's. The reason Hegel thinks it's important is because he recognizes it's an exemplification of matrilineal descent. And therefore, it's important because it is not about the relationship between brother and sister, but about the role of the feminine, which I'm going to argue is his point, and not an argument against him, that he's obsessed with the problem of the sexual division of labor. Secondly, Mills argues that Antigone, in acting, enters the polis, and that Hegel seems to ignore this. What Hegel seems to forget is that in order for Antigone to be a civil disobedient, and that's how she is portrayed, as a civil disobedient, as a lawbreaker, on the basis of principle, of a higher law that the state needs to recognize. So she is, for Hegel has, I should let you know, because it's worth thinking about, Hegel's three great heroes are all civil disobedients. They are Antigone, Jesus, and Socrates. Now that all three of them are fundamentally civil disobedience should be interesting to us about Hegel's interest in them and what he thinks about action. The claim is that he forgets that in order to do that she must leave the family and enter the polis. And indeed she does. She enters into direct argument with Creon. But then, why does Hegel claim this is a structural conflict between the family and the polis? Antigone, Mills wants to say, is a political being, and Hegel does not fully appreciate this. I would have thought the argument is exactly the other way around. That she both was and was not a political being is the point of the entire analysis. It's Creon who refuses to recognize her as having a voice worth hearing in the political world, while simultaneously even the citizens, namely the chorus, are saying, well, Creon, really, the girl has a point. That is, they are already trying to lever her up out of the family into the polis. But exactly how is that supposed to happen? Hegel's thesis is there simply was no structural space, so that she is political and she fails to be political is exactly the tension he's trying to analyze, not bury it, right? Of course, you can celebrate her as a political being,
but that would miss the tragedy again, right? Then you would have already solved the problem.
There's a problem because she cannot be the political being she must be. Otherwise, again, there's no tragedy. Thirdly, Mill says that Antigone is not guilty, but Hegel makes her guilty. Why is Hegel so adamant about the equality of guilt? I've already given a partial answer to that, and I'll come back to it. Fourth, Hegel is presupposing the position of Creon, that is, he's presupposing the truth of the universal. From the point of view of the universal, there is a suppression of women. It is nature, Mills argues, that finally gets suppressed, and culture, the polis, triumphs. Therefore, a woman, she argues, is left outside of history and outside of society. In Hegel, woman is the other, and being the other, she is defined by the universal and cannot define herself. The externality of the women here is defined by male universality. The truly feminine, Mills wants to argue, in an Irigaray sort of way, although Mills really hadn't, Irigaray hadn't really percolated here, but Mills got there anyway. The truly feminine is the other of the masculine defined woman as the other, that is, she is the other of the other. Well, Antigone never does acknowledge any guilt, and Hegel does not explain her power of intervening. Hegel does not explain what power enables Antigone to appear on the public stage. Antigone does not speak with a universal voice. And as I'll say in a moment, she necessarily speaks in a variety of voices, none of which she can fully own. Irigaray's complaint about Hegel, I just want to get them all out there. It's no fun otherwise. Let me explain why I'm saying what I'm saying. My claim is going to be to anticipate that the arguments against Hegel make the argument of the chapter unintelligible. That is, if Hegel's critics are right, then this chapter cannot play the role Hegel is trying to make it play in the economy of the whole. So my suggestion is going to be, not only are these criticisms false, but they are in principle, logically incompatible with the text. Otherwise, the text cannot be an argument on its own. And the reason why this happens, and I should be clear here, is that every single one of these critics read this section in isolation. They look at it on its own as representing Hegel's view of the Greek world and his interpretation of Antigone, and not as a moment in the unfolding of spirit. Not one of these critics, not a one, even the best of them, the best of them is easily Butler, not one of them mentions Rome. Yet Rome is actually part of the same chapter. Right? It's a three-part chapter. The ethical order, the deed, Roman legal status. That's the structure of the chapter. Okay, so that's what I'm going to argue. But before doing so, I need to make sure that I'm fair to the critics. I want the positions to be out there. So Irigaray, of course, takes the famous passage about woman as the eternal irony of community. So while the story is a story of the triumph of human law, is this story the story of the triumph of human law? Almost all the feminist critics say this. I see not one drop of evidence for it. Let that one go. So while the story is a triumph of human law, Hegel recognizes woman's permanent disruption. The divine law, Irigaray says, is the law of earth and blood. So, by their nature, women unsettle the standard rule of reason, of the same and the other. Again, because she is the other to the other she is defined as being by male reason and law. The other of the other is not simply woman, but what does not fit into any neat determined ontology, namely fluidity, movement, holes, slime, and the like. Butler, in her book, also underlines that Antigone never acknowledges her guilt, nor does Hegel explain Antigone's power of intervening. Above all, it is Butler who underlines that Antigone does not have a univocal voice. And she does so by reminding us who Antigone is. She is not only Polynices' sister, she is also his aunt. She is both the sister and daughter of Oedipus. She speaks, when she speaks against Creon, as a man, and unmans her uncle. It's what he complains about. He says, you know, do not unman me, Haemon, do not be unmanned by that woman. I'll come back to those passages later. She is betrothed, in fact, to her cousin, Haemon. So she is a scandalous, performative disruption and perversion of the symbolic and social order. She's, as it were, the living movement of the failure of the incest taboo. And therefore she is the less than human, and it's the less than human, Butler says, that speaks as human. For Butler, Irigaray is simply an essentialist, and her account of radical otherness in terms of an ethics of sexual difference is actually misses out on the actual complexity that is acted out by Antigone. Well, all these analyses, clearly we're not going to finish today, many of these analyses look at, of course, one significant passage, namely, the endlessly long paragraph 475. So let me have to say a word about paragraph 475, and I'll wrap up there, and I'll carry on next week. It is in this paragraph. And I want to do this because I want to give a hint about how I want to do this reading. Top of page 288. Since the community only gets an existence through the interference existence through its interference with the happiness of the family, and by dissolving individual self-consciousness into the universal, dissolving it into the state, it creates for itself in what it suppresses and what is at the same time essential to it, an internal enemy. Womankind in general. Before I read the next sentence, notice what has just been stated. It creates for itself in what it suppresses and what is at the same time an internal enemy. Womankind in general. Womankind, the everlasting irony in the life of the community, changes by intrigue the universal end of government into a private end, transforms its universal activity into the work of some particular individual, and perverts the universal property of the state into a possession and adornment of the family. Woman, in this way, turns to ridicule the earnest wisdom of mature age, which, indifferent to purely private pleasures and enjoyments, as well as to playing an active part, only thinks of and cares for the universal. That's the incriminating passage. About that passage, I want to say two things, and I'll pick them both up next week. The first thing to say is that, again, this is not Hegel's voice. This is the voice of Creon. Indeed, the whole of the movement of the play from around line 650 is exactly about making this claim about the feminine. So he claims, if men live decently, it is because discipline saves their very lives for them. So I must guard the men who yield to order and not let myself be beaten by a woman. Better it must happen that a man should overset me. I won't be called weaker than womankind. And then as the argument between he and the chorus and Haemon goes on, it appears more and more that the debate is really about Haemon taking the woman's role and undermining the goods of the state. So this whole passage is the voice of Creon. It's his argument in the play. How do we know it's not Hegel's argument? Well, I think, lo and behold, we can know it from going on and reading the rest of the paragraph. That is, it's not a bit of a mystery. The community, a bit further down, however, can only maintain itself by suppressing this spirit of individualism. So womankind represents the spirit of individualism. And because it is an essential moment, all the sign, all the same creates it, and moreover creates it by its repressive attitude toward it as a hostile principle.
So what Hegel is here arguing is that by its suppression of womankind, it creates something new, the spirit of individualism.
And it's going to be the spirit of individualism that has been lacking in the Greek world. And that's what he goes on to say. However, this principle, being merely evil and futile in its separation from the universal end, would be quite ineffectual if the community itself did not recognize the power of youth, the manhood which, while immature, still stands within the sphere of individuality, as the power of the whole. For the community is a nation, is itself an individuality, and essentially is only such for itself by other individualities being for it.
So what's emerging here, what Antigone represents, and is going to represent for Hegel, is the emergence of the principle of being not a man or a woman, but being an individual. And it's the spirit of individualism that's going to be called, eventually become subjectivity, that Hegel recognizes as the great achievement of modernity. So it is Antigone who first appears on the stage, and this is the point of the analysis, by breaking the law of the state. She crashes through the equilibrium of roles, and she becomes the first individual. And by becoming the first, and this is her dislocation. Remember, she is neither in the family nor in the state. Well, she's neither in the family nor the state. Where is she? She appears as herself, which is why Hegel talks about her in these awe-stricken terms, the greatest woman to walk the face of the earth. He's struck by her individuality. But it's by dint of this tragic conflict, she is forced into individuality. But it's just that individuality which the Greek state did not know and had no room for and was the cause of the conflict. So rather than, and most telling of the story, it's Socrates who's the first individual, the first subject of this world. For Hegel, it's Antigone. That's why she is a heroine. That she gives rise to the claim of individuality, not by defending the family, but by breaking through role-bound action as such. That is, in fulfilling her role, she goes beyond the idea of role and is forced, she's forced to speak in her own voice. And that, I want to argue, by the way, that that's true of much Greek tragedy. That the women are consistently, because they're sacrificed, because Hecuba's left behind, because all those guys have killed everyone, they're forced to their own voice beyond the role of religion. So the irony here is individual young men are sacrificed to the state and never attain individuality.
It's only women who do the job of Berry that care about individuality. And that caring about individuality has no role in the Greek world except in death. In the denial of Polynices' death, Antigone is forced to make the idea of individuality a claim against the state. Right? Not she makes it in the name of religion, but in making it against the state, she's actually going beyond the structure of religion and state. Isn't Hegel's argument, as I'll suggest next week, then we'll never get to Rome. And we all want to get to Rome, at least for a holiday. And I will next week certainly go on to talk about the chapter on culture and all that stuff.